This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Thank you, Lauren, for being here with me today. I'm hoping that we can talk about how you see the growing support for Palestine right now globally manifesting itself and what that might signify morally and otherwise for the West.
Inshallah. Thanks for asking me.
So much of it's happening in the UK, where you're originally from, but we're seeing it throughout the West. Do you think, on top of the support itself for the Palestinian people and the larger struggle for justice that they're fighting, this signifies some kind of moral shift within Western culture away from individualism or a preoccupation perhaps with the self?
I actually think this is a Gen Z, Gen X moment of awakening. This is suddenly a couple of generations who have been encouraged by commercialism, by other political forces to navel gaze, to become, what am I about? Who am I? How do I justify my being? How do you justify my being? And how do you accept who I am? To suddenly seeing a horror in their midst. This is the most tech-savvy, tech-connected generation in the history of mankind. They haven't been able to avoid a manifest evil. And so suddenly, and this is just my opinion, that energy that's been inside is now, God willing, going to change the world potentially, because that energy is pouring out. It's pouring out so that every genocide-supporting American senator, every pastor, every business person who's investing in war crimes because of their selling of arms deals, for example, or land that doesn't belong to them, they are being pestered. It's the pester power of a generation. They're being pestered and hounded by an angry young people who are saying something really interesting: not on my watch, not never again, not in my name, because these are really diverse young people, but not now, not ever, and not on my watch.
Do you think that it's on account of some kind of moral sensitivity that perhaps earlier generations didn't have, or is it more of a function of today's technology? Because the plight, obviously the plight of the Palestinian people is not new, or their oppression is not new.
You know what? It's like, you know, let's talk about Zionism. Let's talk about the hideous nature of it, which has been unchanged for over 100 years, found its zenith 75 plus years ago in the Nakba, the taking of Palestinian land, and has only grown since. It's been like it's been invisible to the public eye, but out in the open. And now this visceral anger from the Zionists are being challenged. But where were we before? I've really been asking, like, you know, even as someone who's been interested and active for Palestinian justice almost 20 years, how was it possible that they were doing this vileness and we kind of got on with our lives? I think that's the question for humanity now, is this horror is obvious and visceral and hideous, but it's not really changed in its essence. So where were we before?
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that it might have to do with what young people are seeing the Palestinians tell the world, that they're learning something from how they're responding to their plight that's changing them?
Interesting. We are seeing that. We are seeing conversions to Islam. I think one of the areas that hasn't been talked about enough is the fact that the Palestinian people are a faith-based people, Christians and Muslims. And nowhere is that more manifest and clear than in Gaza. These are a religious people. They go to their faith when they are in pain, when they're happy, when they celebrate, when they shop, in their dealings with one another. And we are seeing that now. And the under pressure personality of the person is very interesting, right? So you and I can be nice to each other right now. If suddenly that, you know, everything went off and we were going to be here till midnight, you and I might see a different side to each other. We'd be scratchy, you know, or whatever would manifest. the world is looking at Gaza now and saying, my God, your children are having their eyes explode in front of you. Babies are being cut out of pregnant women who are not having any anesthetic. And you're praising God and you're trying to be calm and you're holding your structure together. Do you know what's interesting? I've got a friend called Yasser from Beit Hanun. And it's hard to say names like that. You know why? Because they're gone. It's like saying Üsküdar in Istanbul. Oh, it no longer exists. Or, Brooklyn. Oh, what was Brooklyn? So I always have to, we take a breath. So anyway, Beit Hanun. And he said to me 10 days into this genocide, he said, you know what, Sister Lauren, I think that they want to make us into animals to prove why they have to kill us by making a struggle for resources. That was day 10. We're now on day 150. And we are seeing, very dignified, gentle people scrabbling onto surfaces, trying to get a sandwich thrown down by their oppressor to keep themselves alive. But they're still not where I think the enemy wants them. They're still not full of a dirtiness and a horror that makes us hate them. And that's the failing of the Zionist image, I think.
Yes. And I'm wondering, because you've been to Palestine and in your own work you've made some very important observations about Palestinian culture, what you think may, within the culture, accounts for this kind of resolve or steadfastness that we're seeing?
You know what? It's I can only talk about Palestinian culture as an Orientalist, because I go and it's all very nice. But I do have an eye in, by the grace of Allah, as a Muslim. When I first went to Palestine, I went as a Christian. So perhaps, and I went as a journalist. So I had an eye in then as someone who framed these people as bad guys, potentially bad guys, some kind of amorphous threat to my Western freedoms. That's how I went, even though I didn't think it was in my mind. But if you're asking me what it is in the Palestinians themselves, I can't speak for them, but I do have an eye in on SAIS. And they absolutely believe with every cell in their being in the dignity of one who believes in one God, and that their children are in Jannah, their dead are in a better place, and the only way that they can reach that place is by being good and steadfast. And it is this determined steadfastness that has really stymied and shocked a clear plan for ethnic cleansing over and over and over again. Now, here's another proof that the Zionists do not belong there. If you go there and you feel this, much less if you feel you own the land, could you destroy 750,000 ancient olive trees? Could you absolutely decimate an area where ancient stones and prophets are and where prophets have walked? No. Excuse me. Not if you believed in any way in a love for that land. The Zionists are alien bodies, are viruses in a beautiful body. They're a virus because a virus kills. A virus does damage. And people are going to freak out. Oh my God, you're calling them viruses. But show me what good they've done for the land of Palestine. All right. We've made it pretty clear you don't want the people. You don't even believe their people are subhuman. You say you love the land. Show us the nurturing of the land. A swimming pool is not nurturing the land, by the way.
Yes. No, certainly. And perhaps maybe drawing from your own experience as a journalist and knowing well the power of story or framing things within a narrative, what do you think might account for this sense of entitlement that we're allowed to do this? What story are they telling themselves?
What is the story that ties the 17-year-old TikToker, eating at a barbecue just outside, 2 kilometers from where people are starving to death? What is the story they tell themselves? It can only be of supremacy. It can only be, we deserve this. But also, there is a get out here. When Zionists wake up when the Jewish fraternity, who have been brainwashed for 3, 4, 5 generations with this real mind control, because we have to remember that Israeli media is very different from anywhere else in the world. You know, they're really not seeing what we're seeing. And at the same time, they have in their hand the same as what we have. They call it Pallywood. They try to say this isn't real. And then what happens is, you know, Zionist filmmakers will deliberately make something false in like Lebanon, right? A fake scene of a hospital, and then go, oh, see, it's all a lie because that's a lie and we can prove that's a lie. But all of that is falling apart now. What is the story they tell themselves? I think it's a story of supremacy and of urgency and of drama and of panic that cannot hold them together any longer. And it won't, because post-traumatic stress, it goes both ways. It goes both ways. You do not get to drive a tank over human beings and go home and have dinner in a normal way. You don't.
And that's a very important point and well taken, because the thought has crossed my mind many times as to how not just the leaders, but Israeli society is able to go on just taking warm showers and eating well when this is happening just some kilometers away.
But are they there? Are they? The rates of domestic violence have spiked. The rates of young depression have spiked. And the airports are full of people wanting to leave. So this is not a healthy society. You cannot export this level of bloodshed and be a normative society. So I've always said this. I think the breaking down is going to come from within. Even, you know, America refusing to take action or dropping a few peanut butter sandwiches along with bombs. It was really interesting and sad this week and disturbing to see, you know, our brothers and sisters in Gaza saying, I'm not going to eat this. I'm throwing it away. Because it matches, it's got the same stamp, the same logo as a bullet torn out of a child's body. So you want us to die with this and eat this? No.
You know, I think it's a very important point, and maybe that's not been really explored enough within mainstream media with the consequences this will have for the society that stands to quote-unquote gain from all this. It's like you cannot do this to a mass of defenseless people and expect to get away with it.
What is going on? I mean, what is the right level of outrage right now? You know, every day we see worse and worse. And I was thinking about it in the way of a period of a lifespan. We have in Gaza now mothers who are having cesarean sections on the ground with blunt utensils with no anesthesia, and the baby is torn from them and the mother dies and bleeds out, and that baby is already alone, traumatized and damaged by the non-state of Israel and by every one of those people who are culpable right the way through all of life, all of the children that we're seeing. You know, six, what is it? How many a day? You can't take in the figures. Is it 6 or 60 losing limbs every day? It's too much to take in for the human heart. Right to, and this is very disturbing, and I think we need to talk about this more in the media. Why are soldiers sent in to destroy graveyards? 16 graveyards in Gaza, which is a small place, but a lot of people, have been totally or partially destroyed. And not just bulldozed, not just skeletons being scattered of the dead, bodies being dug up and taken away. What is that? And then bodies of people who have been murdered, dragged away deliberately by IOF soldiers, and having their retinas taken, being returned without livers, without kidneys, you know, in plastic bags, in bin liners. What is really going on? It's like, you know, honestly, it's like hell has just regurgitated a load of demons now. How do we stay sane? And how do we do anything within this? Well, I have my face. Thanks be to God. Wallahi. You know what's interesting is Biden, because he has some late stage dementia very clearly, sometimes lets things slip out in the way that Trump does, but Trump does it deliberately and manipulative. Like, hey, I've seen the CIA today. Biden's just like, you know, we have to stop this before Ramadan because it's going to look bad. Yes. Oh, my God. Yes, it's going to look bad. Guess what? It looks bad now. It's a genocide, you maniac. It's not a PR opportunity. These people are broken and fractured and psychopaths. We have psychopathic leaders. And what are we going to do about it?
Well, it's a great point because sometimes this has made me question the causes that they do, on the surface at least, say that they support. For example, I mean, because Women's Day is tomorrow, the West very often, Western leaders will very often say that we stand for women's rights. But now, because they're complicit, not even more than complicit, but they're willing participants within this genocide, it's really made me question their sincerity, if it's there at all, even for the causes that they say.
Hang on a second, because women's rights and women's day, yeah, national day, women's annual day, it's all led by white women who want to rescue Arab women from Arab men and black women from black men. Let's make this very, very clear. This is a supremacist version of the sisterhood, because I was in the sisterhood. I put this on. We want everyone to be free. Oh, not while you're wearing that. And these leftist women will turn on you and tear you, shred your reputation, if you just choose to be dignified in this way and not in their way. So I'm not that interested in these global women's days, because there is a section of that female community, I'm sorry to say, who will be looking and going, well, at least the next generation will have freedom. They won't have to marry like the women did before, and inventing this whole image about a society they know nothing about.
Do you feel that Islamophobia or Palestinian, this selflessness of Palestinian culture, the resistance to it on the part of the West has anything to do with it threatening the way that Westerners are expected to be in the world by power? Because if you become other-oriented and you become involved in community, it sort of undermines what you're supposed to do as a consumer. And, you know, eventually that kind of erodes.
Well, that is part of it. And I'm going to say that, and I'm going to add something to it. Don't let me forget. Tariq Ramadan, the scholar, he said over a decade ago, he said, I don't believe it is Islamophobia that's driving Western policy in Iraq and Afghanistan. He said, they don't care what God you follow, but they do care that you buy their stuff. And if you are a believer, you might need two pairs of shoes and you give the rest of your money away. Right? You may have a food, but you'll share it with your neighbor. You are not going to maintain the way that they want to live. Now, I want to just roll back on something, because I think we're at risk here of making the Palestinians into some hippie, like, oh, wow, you know, freedom and love. Let's just be good people, man. No. There are resistance there. And I have had the honor of meeting with them as a journalist. Alexa Marcha's brigades, I've interviewed various Hamas officials. I have even been into the homes of Islamic Jihad in Gaza. And I have never, ever felt at risk. Before Islam, as a journalist, related to a British, a politician, I was never, ever at risk. They told me, we will protect you as long. Anybody who comes to our land, they said, who stands with our people is under our protection. They're not hippies. These are strong people with a right to their land, a right to dignity, a right to their own way of life and their own freedoms. And they have a right to fight for that. Let's be very clear.
No, I think it's an apt comparison for the point that you're making, that they're not quote-unquote hippies, because there's definitely nothing self-indulgent. I mean, sometimes people use the hippie metaphor to kind of say that this person, this group of people, is being self-indulgent. But there's...
New ageism is self-indulgent. And that's kind of our linchpin for anything spiritual at the moment. And that's where we're kind of going wrong, because spirituality isn't, this makes me feel better about myself.
Yes.
This is actually not spirituality.
It's very politically conscious. There's a resistance here. There's a putting your life on the line, which is not self-indulgent at all.
I mean, you know, it's called Alaxa Flood, and we are now coming up to, I probably shouldn't time frame it, but we are about to enter the holy month of Ramadan. And the world is watching as people will be fasting in starvation, period, and that they will be either attacked or denied in their holy space. Yes. Where is your morality, America, Britain and France? Please don't talk to us. Don't export any more of your democracy. Thank you very much. And the United Nations, wow. And the Security Council, just not interested.
Yes, yes. I think it's going to, just because everything's so out in the open right now, I think it's going to somehow undermine people's confidence in the so-called moral foundations of the West and what they mean when they talk about democracy. And I'm wondering whether you see, because there is now a lot more familiarization going on, especially among young people with Islam, as they become involved in their support for Palestine, whether that represents a possible turning point in Western society, morally or otherwise, like, will there be some kind of transformation that we've not seen before that might make people better people?
Only Allah knows that. That's a really big question. Maybe in 200, 500 years, this bit of it will become clear. But I think what there is a hunger and a thirst for is an explanation beyond our own mortality for how to be a good person. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I want to be a sadist today. Yes. It doesn't happen. They justify it, right? That story that the Zionists tell themselves. But we as Westerners, me before Islam, I was telling myself, I've got to get from life whatever I can get. And I'm a good person, but I hadn't visited anybody who was sick. I hadn't really given my time to the poor very much. I hadn't looked after my own mother. What quantifies us? What quantifies goodness? And once we start down that, looking at an ethical framework, by the grace of Allah, you will come to Islam.
Yes, this is a fascinating point, you know, because I think that is one of the, I think you kind of allude to it here, the problems with the West is that things have to somehow benefit me. This hard work, even if I engage in very hard work, strenuous work, it has to pay off for me. The idea that we have, it's like almost a dirty word, that we have obligations, yes, or duties to others, it's almost become like taboo now.
But hasn't that been done deliberately? I don't know who by. Yes. I'm not going to cast any theories here. Yes. But you're right. There is this feeling on all of our social channels, you know, don't ask me to change. Don't ask me to do anything. Who are you to put me under pressure? I should be free to be me. What is that? If everybody's free to be themselves, we're just bumping about in the same space of goo and it's a strange pointlessness. It's a very strange pointlessness because being a part of society takes work.
Certainly, you know, and I think that's the irony too, because presumably the goal of like doing your thing, whatever you want to call it, just being you, is to find fulfillment. But so much of this kind of way of being in the world leaves people, I think, feeling unsatisfied.
And this is something that if you and I were to get into Gaza and go to Rafah next week, yes, inshallah, we would be given food by people with no food. Yes. And they're not getting anything from us. Yes. And we would be very aware of that we are low status human beings, yes, and that they are winning.
As I mentioned to Dr. Gilbert, I feel, just seeing this from a distance as a Westerner, I'm forced to interrogate everything. There's many things I can do it, of course, and the Palestinian people have absolutely no obligation to do this. It's not like their duty, but I feel like it's causing me to interrogate myself. Things that I felt were important or that I need to do, how much is that really wrapped up or tied into self-interest? You know, it's really caused me to think this, because that's how you're sort of raised in the West.
Who do I care about? Who matters? Not only who matters to me, who do I matter to? Yes. And one of the things that I noted in myself before I went to Palestine and met these incredible people of faith and determination and strong culture was nobody would call me and say, can you do this for me? I was not anybody's go-to person. I was the fun person, the drinky person, the flashy person, all right? But no one's going to get on the call and call Lauren and say, can you pick me up from the airport? In that way, we're all pointless. If we're not connected to other human beings as a point person to help them, what really is the point in us? And there's a young girl now, she's 18. She got a scholarship to Istanbul, a university here, 10 days before the genocide started. And she came up to me when I gave a talk and she said, I'm from Gaza. And she started to cry and I sat down with her. She's only 18, never left Gaza. And somebody came over and said, but at least you're not there. You must be happy about that. And she looked at them like, you don't understand this at all. And she whispered in my ear, no, I'm asking God why I'm not deserving of being there under the bombs.
And I almost feel that what Israel is doing is like Westernism writ large, you know, like we will destroy everything and let others bear the cost. You know, we see this, you know, even at the more local level in cities where there's gentrification, people are displaced. And
you're always fleeing from something. In capitalism and in this, their version of modernity, you're always running to the next best thing. And you can leave a trail of devastation behind you, but you've got to get to that. It's to do with not having satisfaction. Yes. And that is something else. The most said word in Gaza is Alhamdulillah. It freaked me out on my previous visits when I was there before I became Muslim. What's this praise and love God and you've got nothing but you know, a shed in Rafah to live in? How are you praising and why? Alhamdulillah, because we're eating today. Alhamdulillah, I have one child, two might be dead, but Alhamdulillah. And then I realized, wow, I lived in a state of permanent ingratitude. And this is something else that modern psychology has got very wrong, Paul, is this idea of do a gratitude journal, okay? Be grateful. Gratitude has two parts, the one expressing the gratitude and the one to whom you're grateful. So if you move this table because it's in my way, I don't say, oh, thank you, table, or I'm grateful to the universe. I thank you for moving it out of my way. It's a two-way process. Who are you grateful to? If you don't know that, you can't even start on the process of gratitude.